The Democrats want change. The Pentagon wants continuity.
I think there are so many talented Democrats in the national security field that were being considered. But I think this situation was so important because at this transition moment, you need the continuity. You need someone like Bob Gates.
Gates stays. General Jones moves up. With the economy center stage, it's apparently going to be a slower transition for the Obama national security vision. What the Pentagon wants, the Pentagon gets. Continuity we need? It's the takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Believe it or not, it's Monday, December 1st. Adora Udoji is off. We're going to get right to the headlines. President-elect Barack Obama's transition team has released enough cabinet trial balloons to clog a Thanksgiving Day parade. Thank you, Mark, from the newsroom. Today, he'll make some widely reported but still unofficial cabinet nominations. He's poised to name Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. He's also expected to keep Robert Gates as Defense Secretary. He'll make that official. And retired Marine General James Jones is set to take the National Security Advisor gig. The last of the hostage sites in Mumbai is now clear. Indian Special Forces killed the last gunman in the Taj Mahal Hotel over the weekend, but it took until today to search every room in the massive complex for survivors and bombs. Residents of the normally bustling Mumbai are trying to go about their bustling again.
The scars are really bad and it has affected the everybody's life. One has to be really strong. And I know Mumbai is strong. Mumbaiites are strong. And we will get back to life again.
Nearly 200 people died in the attack. Several top Indian officials have stepped down amid criticism of security in the country. Femi Okay is here with the headlines. What am I missing, Femi?
Good morning, all. Many Americans spent the Thanksgiving holiday stuck in Thailand. Bangkok's airports are still shut down by anti-government protesters, now leaving an estimated 300,000 tourists stranded in the country. A few managed to get out by trekking to airports in distant cities, like this visitor.
I'm just glad to be getting out now because, you know, I've got visions of being here until Christmas, and the Christmas tree went up in the hotel this morning, so it's quite nice.
Demonstrators brought in reinforcements today, hardening their grip over Thailand's air travel. Election 2008 still rages on in Georgia today, and a GOP superstar is now in the fray. Republicans are hoping to keep the Senate seat there. Sarah Palin will campaign across the state today for Republican incumbent Saxby Chambliss. He's in a surprisingly tough race with Democrat Jim Martin. Now, among the holiday air traffic Sunday, several travelers coming back from an especially long trip.
Gear down and locked. Touchdown.
That's the Shuttle Endeavour landing in California yesterday. Astronauts, yeah, they're just like us. They get delayed by the weather as well. They had to scrap a planned Florida landing because of the stormy skies there. John.
Are you sure you weren't an astronaut at some point?
In my former life.
Thank you.
I think I might have been.
So we are talking about 12% of the workforce. 12% of the workforce is either unemployed or underemployed. It's a shocking number, and it represents an enormous gray area of underemployed temporary workers. How are you making it? Are you a stuck-in-a-temp job or a freelance gig? We'd like to hear your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. The gray, underemployed area, all this week on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. As the cleanup continues in Mumbai, the political repercussions continue across the globe. On her way to London, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said this about Pakistan. It must, quote, follow the evidence wherever it leads. But Secretary Rice said she didn't want to jump to any conclusions. But I do think this is a time for complete, absolute, total transparency and cooperation. And that's what we expect. Rice will give a news conference later on in the morning. So we talked earlier to BBC India correspondent Adam Mayanat about the situation in Mumbai. And one of the gunmen is in custody. And there are some details leaking out about that interrogation. I asked Adam Mayanat if there were confirmed details from that interrogation.
It's very hard, John, separating fact from supposition. But you're right, there is one of the attackers, one of the 10 who was captured alive. He's said to be very badly injured. He's in hospital, but has been giving, we're told, some information to the authorities here, who are clearly very, very keen to talk to him. But as to the status of that information and how accurate it is, it's really very hard to establish. There's certainly nothing on the record, and an investigation is going on. But certainly he has led the authorities, we're told, to believe that the attack was formulated in Pakistan, that the attackers arrived by boat and came ashore here in Mumbai, and then unleashed their wave of terror, killing more than 170 people.
Well, certainly an inflammatory allegation. It remains to be seen whether that will find a higher truth value as the days proceed. At the very least, it's clear that this has had repercussions within the Indian government. Describe what's happened over the weekend.
There's no doubt about that. And I think what has happened is that sentiments have here in the city and indeed of the country of India as a whole have changed from initial shock and grief to something approaching anger and resentment, because it's clear that the security apparatus set up to protect this country didn't deliver. And on top of that, there's evidence coming through that intelligence about this possible attack was circulating and was not acted upon. As a result of that, as you indicate, the National Home Minister, he has handed in his resignation. And in the course of the past few hours, the chief state minister of Maharashtra province, he has offered his resignation. It hasn't yet been accepted, but his deputy has resigned. So this is having a fairly major political fallout. And I think this is probably an indication that there is now going to be a whole restructuring of the way that India views its security, because it was definitely a letdown during the course of the past 3 or 4 days.
Then certainly it's the case that this attack and the repercussions and this restructuring that you're talking about is going to be a key issue as electoral contests get going in the next several weeks.
Indeed. I mean, there are already state elections going on, and this is a build-up towards national elections during the course of the early part of next year. So you're right, this is undoubtedly now going to be a major factor in the elections, and this has burst onto the electoral scene, and already the opposition are making some capital out of accusing the government, the national government and various state governments of not being prepared for this sort of atrocity.
As we can hear there in the background, you're at one of the busiest railway stations in the world there in Mumbai, which was a target of these attacks last week. What's the mood like there this morning?
Well, let me describe the scene to you. And this was the place where the greatest death toll occurred on Wednesday. More than 50 people were killed here when two attackers took up position opposite platform 13. I'm talking to you from platform 9. And they raked the concourse of the station with automatic gunfire. And it was, I'm told, an absolutely horrendous scene of carnage. And these two attackers then went off elsewhere into the city. The people here are gradually getting back to work. I think the people of Mumbai, who are not strangers to this sort of thing, there have been attacks in the city 2 years ago and 2 years before that, and in years preceding that as well. They're quite used to bouncing back, and there is a strong sense of resilience here, but also that sense of anger that I spoke about earlier on.
And certainly, as you say, the carnage at the railway station, these attackers knew exactly what they were targeting.
And that, I think, is underlying the suspicion that this was a well-planned operation, and intelligence had been gathered here in the city by those who carried out this attack well before the assault was mounted. And people are talking about research possibly even beginning a year ago. Not only did they know the layout of the city well, which is perhaps not that surprising, but they also knew very intimately the layout of the Taj Hotel, which was where the long-running siege took place. And it's that iconic image which you see as you enter Mumbai by ship, the gateway of India, with this beautiful hotel behind it, which is now smoke-scarred with blasted-out windows. So yes, this is underlying, as I say, the view that there was intelligence about this operation taking place. It was available here, wasn't acted upon, and that intelligence had probably come from the fact that those who planned this operation had spent so long putting it together.
Well, Adam Minot, thanks so much for joining us. As you say, we're on to the political repercussions angle and the resilience of the people of Mumbai. Adam Minot joined us from Mumbai, India. Thank you, Adam.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Adam Minot is the BBC India correspondent.
We feel frightened that what will happen next. So we are so confused that we feel that we are not safe.
What is next for the people of India? Joining us now from New Delhi is Sudhanand Dume, an Asia Society fellow in Washington, D.C., and author of My Friend, the Fanatic. Sudhanand, it was great having you with us to help keep us sort of close to the facts and the truth last week. As things begin to become clear in New Delhi this week, is this story more about resilience or reshuffling as Indians begin to come to grips with these attacks?
Well, so far it's really a story of both. The reshuffling is really is symbolized by the political fallout, which has been quite intense. We've lost the Home Minister has been changed. The Chief Minister of Maharashtra State, which is one of the largest states, looks like he will be gone too. His deputy has already resigned. So you're seeing very major political repercussions. The regional repercussions, I think, are going to be the story as we look ahead for the rest of the week. And that really is a question of what kind of proof India has of Pakistani involvement and what kind of involvement that is.
And if the proof emerges and is enough for the rhetoric to sort of get ramped up in India, we could be facing in a matter of weeks a situation in South Asia where you have a very weak civilian government in Pakistan and a teetering government in India in the midst of an inflamed, passionate sort of situation of charges and countercharges.
Yes. I do think that that there's going to be tremendous pressure, tremendous domestic pressure to do something, partly because of the enormity of this attack, but also because we must remember that this is not the first attack. This is the first attack on this kind of scale, but India has been suffering tremendously from a series of terrorist attacks, bombings in various cities, and there's a tremendous pent-up anger also. So there will be a lot of political pressure on the government, but at the same time, there will be advice from the international community to make sure that this does not spill into something even larger. So it remains to be seen which way this is going to play out.
Well, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is expected in India and will be holding a news conference later today. But let's go back to let's just unpack the rhetoric of what you're saying. The tremendous pressure to do something. Are you talking about a military retaliation? This isn't as simple as simply closing the border to Gaza like Israel and the occupied territories. It would be hard to figure out what the return address is of these attacks.
I think there will be pressure to show that Pakistan cannot get away with this with impunity. I personally do not see a military strike emerging from this. I think the government has been very careful in its pronouncements so far. It's been careful to link elements in Pakistan rather than the Pakistani state. And I think that there are a host of other measures, including diplomatic measures, that would be considered long before it escalates to the point of a military conflict. However, one thing that is going to be key in the decision-making in New Delhi is to what extent the U.S. government and the international community can assure India that things in Pakistan are going to change and going to change for the better.
Sudhanand Dume is an Asia Society fellow in Washington. He's the author of My Friend, the Fanatic, a book about Islamic militants. He joined us from Delhi. Thank you, Sudhanand. We're talking about underemployment all week long on The Takeaway. We want to hear your story about how you're getting by. What do you wish were in place to help you if you're underemployed?
Corporations are intentionally hiring people part-time so they don't have to pay insurance. And in terms of nationally, there has to be some sort of legislation or rule where they can't do this to people, or there has to be some sort of coverage.
It's a gray area in the economy, the underemployed. We want to hear your story. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We want to remind you all week long we're looking at a gray area in the American economy. If you're a temporary worker, a fill-in, a per diem, a freelancer, what color are your parachutes as you deal with the economic downturn? Underemployment is growing, just as unemployment is. Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Well, certainly one of the strongest personalities ever to be Secretary of State, Colin Powell, found himself overmatched in a competition between the State Department and the Department of Defense during the Bush administration. And one of the significant legacies of George W. Bush is the disparity that now exists between the operations of diplomacy in the U.S. government and the projections of military power in the U.S. government. So the rollout of Barack Obama's security team may be an opportunity to redress that or change it. But joining us to focus on what I think is really the most important issue in the Obama security team is Chief Washington Correspondent for The New York Times, David Sanger. He joins us from Washington. His forthcoming book is The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to American Power. David, thanks for being part of the program.
Good to be back with you, John.
You know, one of the things that you write about, which I think is very, very interesting, is that all three of these characters, and you can remind us, Hillary Clinton, obviously one of them, that's going to be part of this security team for Barack Obama, have openly advocated a return to a certain kind of parity between the State Department and the Defense Department. Explain what's on the record and how this might manifest itself in terms of power.
John, they've done more than discuss a return to parity. They have discussed a great expansion of both American diplomacy and American aid to confront a world in which the wars we're in are wars that are fundamentally unwinnable by military means. You know, if you go back to all those days in college when you had to go read Clausewitz, you know, he said that war was politics by other means. They're going and doing this in reverse now and saying that politics has got to be war by other means. And we're beginning to see a discussion which was started off by Defense Secretary Robert Gates, who is now the once and future defense secretary, about how one needs to build up the institutions to go do this. And, you know, Gates said to me at one point when I was working on my book, he said, you know, we have helicopter pilots who are sitting in here mediating tribal disputes. There's a problem with this. They haven't been trained for this. And they need to work their way back to a civilian reserve corps of diplomats, mediators, lawyers, others who you can parachute in to build institutions.
So as a matter of policy, that makes an enormous amount of sense. But in terms of Washington politics, it was always said to me that when you try to figure out why Colin Powell was having so much problem, sources would tell me, hey, just look at the budget. Colin Powell controls no money.
The Pentagon
controls all the money.
That's right. All you need to do is watch the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense fly someplace at the same time. And the Secretary of State's got this tiny little airplane that, you know, looks like a Piper Cub compared to what the Secretary of Defense flies around. And, in fact, the whole infrastructure we've poured money into is wildly bigger on the defense side. And it was Gates who began using that wonderful comparison you've heard many times, I'm sure, in the past year, which is that we have more members of military marching bands than we have foreign service officers.
Wow.
We spend more. Let me give you one more comparison, John. We spend more on the Pentagon's health care program than we spend on our entire budget for diplomacy.
Wow. I mean, you know, the interesting thing is that that had real policy implications during the Bush administration, in that you'd see these stories where if Colin Powell was traveling to a region, there was a certain amount of interest. But if the generals were traveling, if Tommy Franks was traveling, if CENTCOM was traveling to the region, those were the individuals that the governments really wanted to talk to. How do you reverse that?
Well, one way you reverse it is to begin to think about who the president has access to as he's making his decisions. You know, President Bush talked a great deal about this wonderful secure video system that he had in the White House. He ended up putting it at Camp David, at the ranch in Crawford, on Air Force One. Tony Blair had one. The Pentagon's got one. It's fabulous, John. You flip it on. Up on your screen are all these commanders. You say, where's your problem? What can we do about it? They say, yes, sir, we can go take care of these guys. The problem is, they're the only ones at the other end of the TV screen. You don't get the provincial reconstruction team. You don't get the people who are trying to go rewrite the constitution of Iraq or something like that at the other end of that screen. So you don't get a really full discussion of non-military options from the ground.
So it's a bias towards tactics and an unwillingness or an inability to really deal appropriately with strategy. In looking at these characters that are going to be rolled out today, it seems that maybe we do have an interesting kind of confluence of views, in that Gates is on the record supporting this increased diplomatic corps. Hillary Clinton, of course, very, very high profile. If there was a new diplomatic corps, she would be a very high profile leader of that. And then what about General Jones as National Security Advisor?
You know, if you do nothing else today while you're messing around on the web, and it'll be cheerier than going to go look at the Dow, probably, go and Google the report that James Jones, the former Marine Commandant, did in January of this year on what went wrong in Afghanistan. It's all over the web. It is the most searing account of what we failed to do in a 7-year war, where we would send troops in, take a village, oust the Taliban, leave without reconstructing the place, and guess what? Both the Taliban return and no economic activity happened.
Hmm. So that's interesting, and that's a great suggestion for our listeners. So to suspect that this apparent continuity does not represent change would be a misreading, David Sanger. That's really interesting stuff. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, John. Good to be with you.
David Sanger, New York Times chief Washington correspondent. His forthcoming book, which will be out before the inauguration, is The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to American Power, talking about the national security team that will be rolled out, among the headlines today. And Femi Oke has the rest of them.
Thank you very much. Good morning. The time is 29 minutes past the hour. Alaskan Governor Sarah Palin will be in the peach state of Georgia today. She's campaigning for incumbent Republican Senator Saxby Chambliss. He'll face Democratic challenger Jim Martin again in tomorrow's runoff election. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice will travel to New Delhi on Thursday. She'll express condolences to the Indian government about the Mumbai terrorist attacks. Almost 200 people were killed in the attacks, including 6 Americans. Russia is planning to upgrade its missiles in response to U.S. plans to deploy weapons in space. And that's according to the most recent remarks from a top Russian general. Washington has resisted efforts by Russia and China to negotiate a global ban on weapons in space. That's a look at some headlines making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. I want to remind you that all this week we're exploring this gray area in the U.S. economy, the underemployment sector. Are you a part-time worker? Are you a fill-in? Are you a freelancer? Are you a contractor? Much of the underemployed or underutilized workforce is not even measured in unemployment statistics, and we want you to draw us into that experience. Help us measure what's going on in the economy. Call us with your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. What color are all of your parachutes? So on the election front, one of the big headlines of the election this year was, of course, Californians voting for Proposition 8. It's a ballot measure, of course, that changed the state's constitution to explicitly say that marriage is between a man and a woman. So whatever you may think morally about the ballot measure, it constituted a view and kind of an MRI into the nature and passions of at least one constituency in California, kind of an X-ray into that. African-American voters suddenly can be viewed in a different way as a result of Proposition 8. And here to talk about what the opportunity may be nationally for conservatives campaigning in California and around the country trying to woo African-Americans is New York Times op-ed columnist Charles M. Blow, who came into the studio earlier this morning. Charles, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You know, it was a surprising result to many of us who maybe were kind of passively watching the California race and more focused on Barack Obama. But it probably came as no surprise to most African-Americans in California.
Yeah, I think African-Americans in general are much more conservative than people generally assume because of the way they vote for people at the top of the ticket. They vote overwhelmingly Democratic for the top of the ticket, both in the national elections and most times in statewide elections. But on moral values issues, they are virtually indistinguishable from Republicans.
In your piece with the New York Times, you bust a myth, though, that African Americans actually tipped the balance. It was more complicated than that.
It was. I mean, first, one thing that people, I don't think, realize is how small the percentage of African Americans there are in California. It's less than 7% of the population.
Oh, wow.
But because of all the pop culture coming out of California, and particularly out of L.A., it gets blown up and it feels like there are more people there. So if you take that relatively small number and slice it down by the number of people who maybe actually registered to vote and then by the actual turnout, you get a minuscule
really
number,
yeah, right,
compared
yeah
to other populations. And so, you know, the best thinking now, if you do the math on it, is that the proposition would have passed, even if all the African Americans had stayed home that day.
If you account for gender differences in African American voting, you come up with some really fascinating trends that maybe do constitute opportunities for conservatives more nationally trying to recruit African American voters. Talk about that.
Right. Well, in general, more African-American women vote than African-American men.
And that's a long-standing trend.
It's relatively long-standing.
Yeah.
I mean, I reference 2004 data from the Census Bureau where it's about 40-60, but it's been about 40-60 for a while. In California, if you believe their exit polling, it was a 50% difference and not a 40% difference at the way it is in a national poll. So you have this lopsided voting pattern anyway. In California, what appears to have happened is that the women were even more stridently for Prop 8 than black men were.
And you connect that with church participation
right
between men and women, and you get some really interesting connections.
Right. I mean, blacks are more likely than whites to go to church anyway.
Mm-hmm.
In some surveys and polls, it puts it at about twice the rate. When you go to any black church and you realize that's mostly women. And so
you said it. I didn't.
Yes, I said it. And that church attendance kind of informs its very moral view, very conservative moral view. And I think that leads to a lot of their positions on these moral issues. And I think they become like the moral orbiters of the black community because of that church participation.
Yet the statistics on sexuality and other sorts of things create a certain set of puzzling contradictions within the community, so that even though you have a maybe female head of household, morally speaking, who leads with the conservatism, there are also other things going on.
Right. And what it on the surface, it feels like quite a bit of hypocrisy, you know, or contradiction, as you say. But I think that what I try to make clear in the piece is that what happens on these moral issues is that if you stigmatize them too much, it basically pushes into the shadows and it starts to backfire. Instead of having open conversations about these issues, you have no conversations about these issues, and but the issues don't go away. They just have more unprotected sex, or they engage in riskier behavior, and I think that's what happened.
So the statistic that even though most blacks find premarital sex unacceptable, it's Gallup data. Mm-hmm. But according to data from the Guttmacher Institute, blacks are 26% more likely than any other race to have had premarital sex by age 18. That's a sign of a debate about sexuality that hasn't happened yet in the black community and is going to start now.
Hopes are assumed that it will start now, but I'm not so sure about that. I mean, one thing that we see in the data is that of those 12th graders, the percentage of 12th graders going to church has gone up by 25-26%. Mm. So maybe they're becoming even more religious, not less. So I'm not sure that the trend is looking in a favorable direction. I think that maybe people are becoming more conservative as a result of this, you know, these extraordinary numbers, but also the problem is that is giving them the exact opposite effect that they want.
Right. Well, we'll see if there's a strategy there for politicians who want to exploit some of those interesting contradictions. Charles Blow, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Charles M. Blow is the New York Times op-ed columnist. He joined us here in the studio. And now, headlines from Femi Okeh.
Hello there. 21 minutes to the top of the hour is the time. President-elect Obama is due to officially name more cabinet positions today. Hillary Clinton is expected to be Secretary of State, and Robert Gates will stay on at Defense. The president-elect will also be announcing his Homeland Security Chief, Attorney General, National Security Advisor, and UN Ambassador. Jamie Rubin, advisor to President-elect Barack Obama and a former State Department spokesman during the Clinton administration, is very upbeat about the new cabinet lineup.
I think with Hillary Clinton leading the charge, this will be a well-known team, a strong team, and I think we'll be able to restore respect for the United States around the world.
Do you think he has a job?
I could tell you a really good story about Jamie Rubin. He was planning this job for quite some time. Meanwhile, President-elect Obama will be confirming the new cabinet positions in just over 2 hours' time. The first big snowfall of the season is here. Much of the upper Midwest and Great Lakes area is covered with up to 8 inches. It's caused Thanksgiving travelers to sit tight. Dozens of planes are delayed in the Chicago area. And talking about delays, travelers remain caught in Thailand as well. Stranded passengers stood by as anti-government protesters allowed empty planes to take off from Bangkok's main airport. In a change of tactics, the protesters have asked their members to leave the Prime Minister's compound.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and it's not a hostage situation technically, but tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of flying travelers are caught in the middle of political turmoil in Thailand, where Thailand's main airport is still at a standstill. Actually, there are two airports shut down. Protests are continuing. And for an update, we spoke earlier with BBC correspondent Quentin Somerville from the concourse of Bangkok's main airport.
Good morning there, John. And as I'm speaking to you, there are hundreds of more anti-government protesters in those distinctive yellow shirts streaming past into the airport terminal. They've just been told by their leadership to leave the other site they were occupying in downtown Bangkok, Government House. You might have heard that there was a grenade attack there over the weekend. 50 of the group were injured. So they're now coming here. They believe it's safer here. And that gives you an indication they're not giving up this airport anytime soon.
How are flyers getting in and out? There has to be some sort of movement of tourists.
Well, they're not getting in and out of Bangkok, and that's having a catastrophic impact on the country's economy, which depends on tourism. This is the peak tourist season. Today, though, the People's Alliance for Democracy, who are controlling the airport, they've been here almost a week now, They let around 80 or so aircraft, which have been stranded here. They let them leave, take off from this airport, but they left empty and headed to other airports in Thailand. So travellers will have to head to those other airports, Phuket in the south and Chiang Mai in the north. It's about a 10-hour drive away, but it does give some a bit of hope about getting home. They're actually putting up the Christmas trees in some of the airport, some of the hotels in Bangkok now. Some of the travellers are beginning to worry, will we ever make it home in time for Christmas?
So is there any sense that this standoff here could actually resolve this crisis, that the protesters have escalated it to the point where the government is going to have to concede?
The government is in a very difficult position. They seem to have lost grip on the levers of power here in Bangkok. They can't send the army, and let's just think about it for a second. If Heathrow Airport or if JFK or Hong Kong Airport were taken over by a mob, but the army would be sent in almost immediately. Well, the government can't do that here because the army are against them. The army want the government to step down. They don't want to get involved in a coup, as they did back in 2006, because they feel that didn't work out very well for them. So the government's relying on the police, and the police have been very reluctant to get involved in this. They have abandoned the few checkpoints they had outside the airport after they were overwhelmed by the superior numbers of the protesters. The government, in fact, has fled Bangkok. They're in Chiang Mai in the north. It looks increasingly unlikely that this situation will be resolved in the government's favour. And, in fact, we saw a pro-government supporter who came near the airport today being wrestled to the ground, punched and kicked and dragged away by the security personnel who work with the anti-government protesters, which also makes you think that this isn't going to end peacefully.
All right, Quentin, very, very quickly, if there's no police, no army, and no government, what's the end game here? What's going to change things? Very quickly.
Well, they're just going to wait it out. The anti-government protesters believe they've got the upper hand. This is the crown jewel, this airport of the Thai economy. Without it, the country's grinding to a halt.
In the center of that grinding to a halt is BBC correspondent Quentin Somerville, who spoke to us earlier from the concourse of Bangkok's main airport, which is still closed in a government dispute that has trapped hundreds of thousands of flying travelers.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Do you know what the real unemployment rate is in the United States? Think about it. We'll have an answer when we come back after headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thanks, John. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The last of the hostage sites in Mumbai is now clear. Indian special forces killed the last gunman in the Taj Mahal Hotel over the weekend, but it took until today to search every room in the massive complex for survivors and booby traps. Only one militant was taken alive, and Indian security says that he's part of a Pakistan-based group. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is headed to the region, and she's encouraging Pakistan to help the investigation. Hundreds are dead after a series of violent clashes between Christians and Muslims in central Nigeria. Soldiers are now patrolling the streets with orders to shoot troublemakers on sight to keep order. Elsewhere in Africa, a deadly anthrax outbreak is spreading through Zimbabwe. The country is already braving a cholera epidemic and ongoing political turmoil. Anthrax is normally a livestock disease, but severe food shortages have the hungry eating animals killed by anthrax. Today is World AIDS Day, and Mark Dybul is the coordinator of US Global AIDS Program. He says that the economic crisis won't affect the budget to prevent AIDS in developing countries.
We need a developed world, and that means tackling disease, tackling all development issues, or we will not have a future together as a world. It's the same vision that there was when the Marshall Plan was adopted to rebuild Europe. Money was tight then as well, but people had the foresight and vision to say that would matter for the future, and it turned out to be the right call.
The U.S. has pledged billions of dollars over the next 5 years to help in the fight against HIV and AIDS. An estimated 2.7 million people become infected with HIV each year. That's a look at some main stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi. So I asked you about the unemployment rate, but do you know the underemployment rate? Who would be in that category?
My family and I got into debt because my husband was unemployed for almost 2 years. When I did return to a job paying what we thought was a decent salary, it certainly wasn't enough. We were so far behind just on basic bills that we're trying desperately to play catch up. We've both had to since take on additional ways to earn a living, and that has certainly stressed us in a huge way.
Additional ways to earn a living. It's called the underemployed or the temporary workforce, and it's not really measured in this economy. We're going to talk about it in a moment, but we want to hear your stories all week long at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. And the reason it occurred to us to focus on underemployment this week is that so many people in the job market, the part-time worker, the contingent worker, temporaries, distressed, discouraged, fill-ins, all of these words, all these familiar terms are not measured. These workers make up a kind of gray area in the labor market, and many of them would like full-time jobs and get the benefits that go with them but can't find the jobs that go with them. And so in the first installment of a new series about the growing part-time workers and the underemployed, Paul Osterman, professor of human resources and management at the MIT Sloan School of Management, joined us from the studios of our partner WGBH in Boston. Paul, thanks so much for joining us.
Happy to. Thank you.
I mean, it's frustrating to me to think that, for decades, it seems like almost three decades, we've been talking about entrepreneurs and sort of strategic employment and, you know, people using flex time and having home offices, that the underemployed would be so unmeasured in the unemployment stats.
Well, we actually do have some sense of that. So the official unemployment rate today is about 6.5%.
Right.
It's gone up substantially. If you add to that people who are working part-time but would like to have a full-time job, that's about another 7 million people. And if you add to those folks people who would like to find work but have given up, what we call marginally attached to the labor force, you end up with a total, what you might call underutilization rate, of just under 12%. It nearly doubles the unemployment rate.
And I guess the question would be, how much of that underemployed, the temporary workers who would like to find full-time work, are actually an unmeasured engine of positive growth versus a sense of frustration that they can't find the job that they're looking for?
Oh, there's nothing positive. If you're working part-time but you want a full-time job, or you'd like to work but you feel you can't find a job, you've given up, you're discouraged, there's nothing positive about that. These are people who are in serious trouble. They're in trouble in much the same way that somebody who's unemployed, as we usually understand the term, is unemployed.
So let's talk then specifically about employers. It seems from these statistics that there's a lot more flexibility for employers in the way they categorize their workers than there is for workers attempting to get by in this economy.
Right. So starting in the, say, mid-1980s and going forward, firms started looking for ways to, and there's a lot of euphemisms here, right-size, downsize, delayer, make more flexible their workforce. So they used a variety of strategies. Contingent work, temporary work is one, part-time work is another. A huge strategy, very important, is outsourcing. Instead of having the work done by your employees on site, you hire another firm to do the work for you. All of these are ways to create more flexibility from the employer's perspective. But from the worker's perspective, it creates much more uncertainty and insecurity. And that's been a substantial trend.
Does this argue for some sort of national policy to take underemployed workers, temporary workers, and put them under some sort of benefit umbrella that would give them a minimum set of benefits or a minimum set of security?
Yes, it does. There's actually two sets of issues. One is figuring out who's the kind of real employer, who's responsible for health and safety, who's responsible for making sure that there's not sexual discrimination and so on. And these different kinds of employment arrangements create some ambiguity about who's the legally responsible employer. And then the second issue is people who are contingent, who are contract workers, who are temporary, are much less likely to have health insurance. They're much less likely to have pensions. And that, as we all know, creates significant problems both for them and actually for the economy as a whole.
We've mentioned mostly temporary workers or people who are working in these kind of contract per diem arrangements. But I'm wondering if there's any statistics on how people who are the so-called discouraged workers, the people who have given up, how they're getting by. What sorts of strategies work in that? I wouldn't even call it a gray area. It's probably darker than gray.
Well, in terms of how they're getting by, what you see in a recession like this is that when somebody loses their job, if there's another family member, that person enters the labor force. So that, of course, then if you have kids, puts enormous pressure on your family in terms of childcare arrangements, a variety of kinds, puts just much more tension in your life. So one way people get by is by having family members or relatives help them out by entering the workforce. Beyond that, it's tough to get by. Some people have unemployment insurance, but over the years, the number of people who are eligible for unemployment insurance has fallen.
And if you're in this temporary worker world, you aren't eligible for unemployment at all.
That's exactly right. And we need to update our unemployment insurance system. Today's unemployment insurance system is basically based on the assumption that there's a full-time worker who, often a male, that's the assumption, who has temporarily lost his job and is going to get recalled.
And that's not the way it works anymore.
That's not the world we live in anymore, but that's the world of the unemployment insurance system. We need to update that.
So, Paul, the takeaway on this conversation, it seems to me, is that for at least half and maybe most of the people who are categorized in this sort of absolute 12 million unemployed workers, underutilized workers, half of them have no social cushion really at all if they were to lose their job, right?
Well, I would say more than half of them. I mean, people who are unemployed have little social cushion too, right? So we're talking about 12% of the workforce are either unemployed or working part-time involuntarily or are discouraged in some real sense. About 12% of the civilian workforce is in one of those categories. Many of those people, most of those people, are very much on the margin. It's a very difficult situation for them.
And it's going to just get worse with the numbers over the next year. Paul Osterman, Professor of Human Resources and Management at the MIT Sloan School of Management, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Paul Osterman joined us from our partners, WGBH, in Boston, Massachusetts. So, sound familiar? Freelancers, per diem? We're talking about underemployment all week long, and we want to hear your story about how you're getting by. Are you working three jobs, working under the table? How are you making it, and aren't you?
It strikes me how attaching benefits to employment has created an incentive to avoid employing people. I don't know what to do about it, but it seems pretty silly.
Well, imagine the intent of employers, or tell us your personal story of employment at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. We're always on here at The Takeaway. We'll continue to follow the story in Mumbai that has left more than 170 dead. We have much more for you to go to on our podcast. Here's your takeaway.
We have more members of military marching bands than we have foreign service officers. We spend more on the Pentagon's health care program than we spend on our entire budget for diplomacy.
That says it all. David Sanger, New York Times chief Washington correspondent, with your takeaway. The Obama security team will be rolled out in about an hour and a half. I'm John Huckenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Instant gratification. The American dream.
If you want it all now, I want it all now.
Want it all? It turns out that kind of short-term thinking may run the risk of dashing all of America's dreams. Finding the patient, strategic entrepreneur inside a nation of I want it now softies. It could be the recession's real silver lining. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Monday, December 1st. Adora Udoji is away. We're actually going to have a serious discussion about whether our brains are hardwired for adversity in this economic downturn. It could be a silver lining, but we'll get right to the headlines. After weeks of trial balloons, rumors, and speculation, President-elect Barack Obama unveils key administration nominees a little later this morning. Spoiler alert, if it's a surprise to you, we're pretty sure Hillary Clinton gets the Secretary of State nomination and Robert Gates will stay on at the Pentagon. Retired Marine General James Jones will be National Security Advisor. Jamie Rubin worked in President Bill Clinton's State Department and has advised the Obama team. He's a fan of the new lineup.
I think with Hillary Clinton leading the charge, this will be a well-known team, a strong team, and I think we'll be able to restore respect for the United States around the world.
And possibly restore the name of Jamie Rubin around the world. The president-elect will also announce picks for Attorney General, Homeland Security, and UN Ambassador. And there are nominations. The cabineteers can't actually update their resumes until they clear Senate confirmation hearings. That will be next year. Most of the above gigs will include plenty of time dealing with Iraq. The news from there today is bleak. More than 30 dead after a string of bombings targeted Americans and Iraqis in Baghdad and Mosul. Femi Oke is here for the rest of the headlines. What am I missing, Femi?
Oh, well, the last of the hostage sites in Mumbai is now clear. Indian Special Forces killed the last gunman in the Taj Mahal Hotel over the weekend, but it took until today to search every room in the massive complex for survivors and bombs. Only one militant was taken alive. Indian Security Forces say he's part of a Pakistan-based group. Most in Mumbai are back at work today. Some commuters had harsh criticism of their leaders.
There is definitely a failure from government, no doubt about that, because such things are happening again and again.
Several top Indian officials have stepped down in the wake of the attacks. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is on her way to the region. She's urging Pakistan to help in the investigation. Rice holds a live news conference in just a few minutes. We'll listen in and bring you any big news out of that conference. And Sarah Palin campaigns again today. This time she's working to get out votes for Georgia Republican Senator Saxby Chambliss. Chambliss is in a runoff election tomorrow with Democrat Jim Martin.
And if Palin has an impact there, you can look for her standing to rise in the Republican Party. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
So part-time, temp, fill-in, per diem, freelancers, permalancers, what do you think of when I say the word underemployment?
The whole museum structure of hiring freelance people and now the use of more and more interns that it almost starts feeling like we're union and they're scabs.
Is it union busting or entrepreneurship? Tell us your story of underemployment at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We begin with the Wall Street opening in about a half an hour. It's going to be lower on this first day of December. At least that's according to the futures trading, but we will see what happens later on in the day. Already markets in Asia and Europe were down about 1 to 2.5%. Barack Obama is expected to name, of course, Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, along with a number of other people on his national security team within the next hour and a half. But joining us now to talk about what this team means and how it has a newfound urgency with the wake of the attacks in South Asia and Mumbai is Peter Baker of The New York Times. Peter Baker, thanks so much for joining us from Chicago.
Good morning. How are you today?
Great. The Hillary Clinton announcement is not particularly new. It seems to me perhaps the most interesting appointment in the Gates-Clinton nexus here is National Security Advisor, apparently, retired Marine General Jones. Describe, first of all, the significance of Jones and where he's likely to fit in a triumvirate of Gates, Clinton, and Jones.
Well, Jones was the Commandant of the Marine Corps and the Supreme Allied Commander of NATO in Europe, and he's a very, you know, he's a very strong figure who has some strong ideas about what to do in Afghanistan and Iraq. He wrote a report within the last year that said, make no mistake about it, we're not winning in Afghanistan. A very strong warning to the establishment that things were not going well there. So he's going to be a figure who's going to come in and give a new look to the most important, you know, policies that are underway for the United States right now, and somebody who probably can stand up to very prominent figures at both the Pentagon and the State Department.
Is there any suggestion that somewhere in the fine print of this announcement today that there will be a deputy named, a kind of Obama's man at the Pentagon who will report to Obama but be under Secretary Gates, or is the deputy structure going to remain the way it is so far?
Well, I don't think they're going to announce that today, but there will be a strong deputy under Secretary Gates. Everybody believes it will be Richard Danzig, who was the Navy Secretary under President Clinton, and he will be seen by many as the heir apparent when Secretary Gates eventually moves on. And that does create sort of an awkward and unusual situation where you have a defense chief who is in some ways undercut by his deputy, because everybody sees a deputy as the one who's the real choice for the next president. But they seem to think it's going to be old. They're going to make that work anyway, that Gates will continue to wield the sort of authority he ought to wield in order to really run the very, very complicated building he'll have.
Well, let's talk about that, the complexity, for a moment. You know, over the weekend, I don't know if you heard it, Bob Woodward, and we don't necessarily want to make headlines of what Bob Woodward has to say. He proposed a theory that the economic situation was so urgent that Barack Obama was essentially willing to give some very autonomous characters, purview over the world, including Hillary Clinton and Robert Gates. After the attacks over the weekend, you can't really say that that's going to be a credible approach to national security as we go forward here, do you?
No, I mean, I think the Mumbai attacks showed that no matter how much you think your administration may be about one thing, or the economy at the moment, the national security can raise its head at any given moment. It, literally overnight, suddenly you have a whole new reality that you have to deal with as President of the United States. One right now is about not just terrorism, but keeping Pakistan and India from escalating the situation into a very dangerous showdown between two countries with nuclear weapons. So, you know, I don't think there's ever a time, and particularly in today's era, where you can sit there and say national security is on the back shelf while we focus on the economy. It's going to always have to be on the front burner.
Now, because this is, involving a Clinton, Peter Baker, it's undoubted that reporters sitting at this event at 10:40 Eastern time will have stopwatches measuring precisely the amount of time Hillary Clinton talks versus the amount of time Barack Obama talks, and then attempting to decipher whether this was staged properly and delivered the right message of who's reporting to whom. How important is all that atmospheric business this morning?
That's a good question. You know, I'm trying to remember, frankly, I'm not sure that any of President-elect Obama's previous nominees have actually spoken at these events. I think it's only been the president-elect himself who gives comments about each of his nominees and then takes questions from reporters. So, yeah, you know, if you follow that pattern, I'm not sure you'll see Senator Clinton talking at all this morning. And it's a good question. That would be an interesting reflection of a new reality. Here's a person who for a while was seen as the front runner to become the next president, won 18 million votes during the primaries, came very, very close to beating Obama, and now is just somebody who stands behind him silently. That's
an interesting
change in dynamics. Yeah,
it's certainly that we can predict that the Daily Show's camera will be on Hillary Clinton's body language for tonight's broadcast if she does stand there and say nothing.
That's right, exactly.
Thanks, Peter. I won't get you in trouble on that. We'll go. Peter Baker, New York Times reporter, focusing on the security team being rolled out by the Barack Obama transition team later today. He joined us from Chicago. And now, referring to those attacks in Mumbai, joining us now is BBC correspondent Sanjoy Mamjunder from Delhi. Good morning, Sanjoy.
Good morning.
I know it's afternoon for you, but we've already discussed this morning of what the political fallout has been of the Mumbai attacks in India, and it seems to be deepening this morning and this afternoon.
Well, it's inevitable, really. I think what you're seeing, or what you have seen over the past few days, once the attacks concluded, is rising public anger. And while the government of India has been focusing on Pakistani involvement or possible Pakistani involvement in the attacks, I think what Indians are looking at is their government and why the systems that are in place to prevent this sort of thing apparently failed. And they want some answers. And so we had yesterday a very high profile resignation. The top cabinet member in charge of internal security, the Minister of Home, Shivraj Patil, was replaced. This morning, we've had two leaders in the state of Maharashtra. That's where Mumbai is the capital. Both the leader of the state and his deputy tendering their resignations. And I think it's the beginning of a very long process of accountability and overhaul.
Or perhaps a very short process. Sanjoy Mamjunder, this has some very strange echoes of the situation in Spain, where a terrorist attack right before a political election completely rewrote the government in Spain. Do you suspect that that may be repeated here?
It could very well do. I think that's one of the biggest fears of the government. We are actually in the midst of an election season. We have a number of state elections that are taking place at the moment, and they're all leading towards the big one, the general election, which is meant to be held before May 2009. At the best of times, the government was facing a tough re-election given the economic crisis that's affected just about everyone around the world and certainly affected India. Now we've had this terror attack. It doesn't look very good for the government, particularly when the opposition is seizing the moment, is accusing the government of being weak on terror, is basically driving nails into the cabinet, saying that, you know, they need to go. So it's a very difficult situation for the government. And it's a very dangerous one for the region. When you have a government that's weak, that has its back to the wall, you have a nuclear armed neighbor to our west. And there are implications that in some way or the other, maybe some Pakistani militant groups were involved. It's a cocktail that can really lead to a very dangerous situation.
With really two weak governments, if you count the fledgling civilian government in Pakistan. Not to make too much of this Spanish connection, but the government in Spain, after that terrorist attack, really poorly handled the question of accusations of who was responsible for it versus the internal political turmoil that came as a result, and really mismanaged that. Do you see the Indian government attempting to derail political criticism by focusing, maybe jumping to conclusions about who was behind this?
I think, yes, that's definitely happening here. It certainly appears so, because very, very soon after the attacks, in fact, even before it was completely over, we had the government basically beginning by leaking information, saying that they were convinced that these were attackers who'd come from Pakistan. Since then, of course, the foreign minister went live on television to accuse Pakistan directly of having some kind of hand in these attacks. And in the last few minutes, I can tell you the Pakistani ambassador in Delhi has been summoned by the foreign ministry. We don't know what's been said, but I think the message would have been fairly evident. So there's definitely a question of maybe India, I wouldn't say jumping the gun, because no doubt they probably have evidence to suggest that maybe, you know, militant groups in the region, such as Al-Qaeda or the affiliates, could have in some way be responsible for this attack, because this was, after all, a very sophisticated attack, a military type assault.
But it's very much, you know, hot information politically, both domestically and internationally. Sanjoy Mamjunder, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Sanjoy Mamjunder is Delhi correspondent for the BBC.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. So our question for this week is, what color is your parachute? Or maybe better question is, how many parachutes do you have? And, you know, this could be a positive story, but Girl Scientist writes on our website, I'm an underemployed person. I'm a research scientist with a PhD, postdoctoral fellowship. I've been surviving barely by freelance writing, pet care, and private tutoring. Now that the economy has taken a serious downturn, I've not been able to find anything to support myself. Unfortunately, I am single without any family at all, without health or dental care, and incredibly discouraged, in despair about my career options, and in fear for my future and my life in general. And that's from a PhD. We're talking about underemployment all week long. I want to hear your story. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Well, of course, this morning, the charges and countercharges in the aftermath of the attacks in Mumbai are continuing between Pakistan and India. Joining us now is Christine Fair, who's a senior political scientist with the RAND Corporation, joining us from Washington. Christine, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We wanted to get a sense from you of the Pakistan side of the equation here. Already we've heard from a number of people from inside India that there's tremendous temptation on the part of the Indian government to sort of push a hard line with Pakistan. Where does Pakistan stand at this point?
Well, in point of fact, everyone should be pushing a hard line on Pakistan. You know, this particular group that appears to be connected to this attack, and before I go further, I should point that, you know, India is also going to have to pony up some evidence. I was on the phone last night with a very well-respected and well-placed journalist who covers this issue, and the evidence does, in fact, appear to be compelling of Lashkar-e-Taiba's complicity. But that being said, India is going to have to be more forthcoming on the evidence. At the same time, this particular group has been operating in Pakistan with complete impunity. It was originally banned in 2002, but however, days or hours before the official ban took place, it reorganized under a different name, Jamaat-ul-Dawa. It has a website that's completely free and open, completely free and functioning. You or I or anyone, for that matter, can go there and peruse the website. It was delivering assistance to earthquake victims in 2005. The same group has been attacking U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan, in Kunar, and Nuristan. So the time has really long passed for the United States, working with its partners, to put a very firm line on Pakistan that this and other groups needs to be decisively eliminated.
Well, Christine, what do you make of this kind of rhetoric that we heard over the weekend coming out of Pakistan? Here's Shah Mahmood Qureshi, who's the Pakistani foreign minister. Take a listen.
We have nothing to be ashamed of, because this government feels that good neighborly relations with India are in the interest of Pakistan.
Now, is that just a whitewash, or is there anything to that?
Well, unfortunately, this is precisely the kind of language that we have always heard from Pakistan when a Pakistan-based group is alleged to have conducted operations outside of its borders. There is nothing atypical about that language. Now, a couple of important things to note about Pakistan. The civilian government doesn't actually control the military or its external intelligence agency, the ISI, and its control over domestic intelligence agencies is somewhat complex and disputed. So in some sense, the civilians probably had nothing to do with this. The question arises is, A, whether or not the attack in India was actually sponsored by this Pakistan group, this Pakistani group and its headquarters, i.e., was this really a Lashkar attack, or was this an attack perpetrated by people calling themselves Lashkar? And then the second question is, if it was in fact a Lashkar attack, Lashkar-e-Taiba, unlike some of the other groups in Pakistan, really hasn't broken away from the ISI. It hasn't targeted the Pakistani state. It hasn't become a rogue operator as some of the other militant groups has. And that naturally raises the question, therefore, if this was really a Lashkar attack, was the ISI involved?
All right, let me do an acronym alert here for our listeners who may want to actually go to that. No, so we're talking about Lashkar-e-Taiba.
Yeah, Lashkar-e Taiba, and they frequently get called LET.
Right.
And the ISI is the Inner Services Intelligence Directorate, which is variously called ISI or ISID.
Right, and ISI is more familiar, I think, to our listeners, but there are going to be a lot of people who are going to want to Google Lashkar-e Taiba or LET. So
The Indian agencies sometimes call Lashkar-e Taiba Lashkar-e Toyaba, but unfortunately that's an inaccurate transliteration of the Urdu. It is Lashkar-e Taiba.
All right, one question about India. There's already talk that the Indian security forces missed this. If it's so clear to you the existence of this organization and its connection to Pakistan, how come the Indian government couldn't have been more vigilant here?
Well, I mean, a couple of things. First of all, even I, when this attack first broke out, I was very suspicious that it wasn't Lashkar. And the reason for that is that it was being reported that this was a hostage taking. And Lashkar had never before taken hostages. And it turns out this was not a hostage crisis at all. And you saw in the early handling of the Indian events that they thought it was a hostage taking as well. But there are a couple of different issues that are kind of packed into your question. The first is, what was the so-called intelligence chatter that the Indians had preceding the attack?
And there apparently was some.
There was some. In fact, my contact in India told me that the Indian Coast Guard even sent out a mission trying to track down these guys, and they couldn't find them.
Wow.
You know, and I always like to remind people, even before 9/11, our intelligence apparatus, and we know this from the Woodward book, from all the various congressional testimony that's come out subsequently, we had various chatter about something truly horrific and gruesome taking place. Even parts of our government knew the 9/11 hijackers were in our country, but we were unable to preempt that. And the Indians have the same problem.
Is this tactic of 12 guys with automatic weapons fanning out across a city something that's likely to be repeated outside of India, and are terrorism experts looking at this?
Well, I presume they are. I mean, one thing that comes from this is that what this required was planning, obviously, and good execution and good training. It turns out, according to my colleague in India, that these guys were, in fact, incredibly competent fighters. And this does raise the question about where they obtained this kind of training.
And where it might be applied next.
Absolutely.
Christine Fair, thanks so much for joining us. She's a senior political scientist with the RAND Corporation, and she joined us from Washington. And with the headlines, Femi Okeh is here.
Thanks, John. Just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. Alaskan Governor Sarah Palin is in Georgia today. She's campaigning for incumbent Republican Saxby Chambliss. Here's what she said at a rally this morning.
If we are to lead again in changing Washington for the better and to put government back on your side, it takes rebuilding, and I say let that begin here in Georgia tomorrow.
Chambliss will face Democratic challenger Jim Martin again in tomorrow's runoff election. Wall Street will be open in just a few minutes. It was a mixed day in Asia and a lousy day in Europe. Investors are sure to watch how retail sales go now that the holiday season has begun in earnest. And in about an hour, President-elect Barack Obama will announce four more cabinet positions. He's expected to be accompanied by Hillary Clinton. That's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Here's a story of underemployment. I was laid off from my job of 5 years as an adjunct professor, applied for unemployment, collected $256 for 8 weeks. But then, because of the way I file my taxes as an artist, as an independent contractor, I was told I was not eligible. Now I have no income. If I don't pay the back money I collected, I'm guilty of a crime. Why do the self-employed not qualify for unemployment insurance? Other stories.
I'd like to tell you a little story about recently having been in a convenience store. An employee there was looking for something, you know, in the snack section. And I said, oh, you hungry? I said, lots to choose from. And she said, oh, yeah, I just can't afford anything. In the store she's working in, I had to lend her money to buy a lunch break meal at the store she worked in that sold tons of food.
Tell us your underemployment stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. Well, they're still counting the votes in Minnesota. Have you been paying attention? Tom Scheck from Minnesota Public Radio joins us this morning. He's all over this recount, which is pretty dramatic stuff. Tom, where does it stand at this point?
Well, John, Norm Coleman leads by about 4,000 votes. 86% of the ballots are counted, so they're hoping to get the rest of the ballots counted this rest of this week. They have a deadline of Friday to finish it. But that doesn't mean that this race is going to be over, because there's this little thing called where these folks can challenge ballots, challenge the determination of local elections officials. So all of those challenged ballots, and right now we're near close to about 5,000 ballots in total. They go to a separate body called the State Canvassing Board, and they're going to go through these ballots one by one and say, okay, that is a vote for Al Franken. We think the voter's intent here is a vote for Norm Coleman. We're not sure about this one. Let's toss it out. So that's going to be a process that's going to start on December 16th, and then they're going to hopefully get that done in 3 days, they say.
I want to ask you about this absentee vote setback that happened that appears to favor Norm Coleman. And also, it appears that the raw numbers, forgetting the challenge ballots for a moment, in terms of raw numbers, the recount extended the lead of Norm Coleman by something on the order of 3,800 votes?
Well, that's kind of the case, and you have to factor in the challenge ballots portion of this, because it's hard to put the two aside, because when these folks go in there and they start to challenge ballots, say Norm Coleman's folks challenge one ballot, Franken's folks feel like they have to do the same thing. So it turns into this almost arms race type of deal. Now, there was a setback last week for Al Franken's campaign. He was talking about he wanted to include these rejected absentee ballots, because Minnesota has a law where they have to have reasons and a couple of rules that folks have to follow if they want to vote absentee. And what the Franken folks have found is that, you know, some folks had their ballots rejected and they shouldn't have been. You know, the typical rules are they have to have a reason why they're out of town. They have to sign the back of an envelope, those types of things.
But in general, Tom, the bar is higher for absentee ballots, right? I mean, there are more restrictions on those than for regular ballots. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, that's correct. But what they found is the Franken campaign has found that there have been some folks who they've done everything right. They feel like they've done everything right and that those ballots should be counted. They were on time. They signed the envelope. They had a witness, those types of things. And they wanted this canvassing board, that group I talked about earlier, to consider all of these rejected absentee ballots and see whether they were lawfully set aside or not. And the canvassing board came out and they said, you know what? That's not our role. We looked at the state statute. We're not supposed to be doing that.
So even though they will be looking at intent of the voter in the regular ballots, they won't be looking at these kinds of intent issues for the absentee ballots in the mind of the Franken people.
Yeah, and that's correct, because basically they say this isn't our role. The local elections officials decided one way or another that this ballot should not count. It wasn't counted on election day. If they want to go back and take a look at this, you know, that's their intent, because they're allowed under state law to go back and say, boy, we made a mistake here. And some counties have done that a little bit, where they've said, you know what, this was a clerical error. This should be counted. And that vote ends up getting counted. But this is all laying the groundwork for the Franken campaign for an election contest, which means they're going to go to court and they're going to say, you know what, we feel like someone's vote didn't count. A voter can do this. A campaign can do this. And they can say, you know, we want to challenge this because a vote did not count. Then the courts could go through and start sorting through all of these challenged ballots, or these ballots that folks feel that didn't count that should have. They can go through that as well. So even though we say December 19th is the day, everyone who kind of follows this really closely knows that that may just be the end of the regular period, and we may be going to double overtime.
Is there any way constitutionally that a court challenge could force a runoff here, or would it have to be some kind of reconstitution of the existing ballot?
The court could – we've actually looked at this, and the court could, if there's an allegation of voter fraud, or if they feel like votes didn't count, the remedy for this is another election. Would be something happens. But that's
kind of – that would include the third candidate, or would it just be with the top two?
No, it would be whatever whoever wants to get back in the race.
Right.
So it could be five, six candidates, depending on who wants to get in. So,
Minnesota Public your website has been making much of this whole contest. I mean, there have been pictures of ballots on your website. I think you even have a recount song that you've been playing on your website.
I actually haven't heard the recount song, but I try and stay away from the artistic equivalent. But we did post all of these ballots, and you get a good sense of where these challenges are coming from and how people actually vote. It's one of those things that are pretty funny.
God love the people of Minnesota, Tom. Listen to this. That's from a song about recounts back in 1963.
What causes these switches is
do you sing in a choir, Tom?
Absolutely not.
Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio reporter, covering the Coleman-Franken recount there in the Twin Cities. Thank you, Tom.
You got it.
It's not true that everyone in Minnesota has to sing in a choir as a condition of state citizenship. No, that's a myth. That's a myth. And here to bring us all the truth, starting with the markets, is Femi Okay with the headlines.
Hello there. Good morning to you. 21 minutes to the top of the hour. John, you do the markets because I don't have the markets open.
Yeah, the Dow opened much lower this morning, as you predicted. It's down about 3% to 260 points down. The S&P is about the same.
Thank you very much. Just getting in some news from Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. She's in London this morning. And at a press conference a few moments ago, Secretary Rice said that the perpetrators of terrorist attacks in India must be brought to justice. And she will be travelling to New Delhi, India on Thursday as a show of support for the Indian government. Anti-government protesters who've occupied Bangkok International Airport have agreed with the authorities to allow nearly 90 aircraft stranded there to leave, but they will be leaving empty without passengers on them. Earlier, we spoke to the BBC's Quentin Somerville about the situation for trapped travellers in Bangkok.
So the government's relying on the police, and the police have been very reluctant to get involved in this. They have abandoned the few checkpoints they had outside the airport after they were overwhelmed by the superior numbers of the protesters. It looks increasingly unlikely that this situation will be resolved in the government's favour.
There are now about 6,000 protesters at the airport and 300,000 travellers, many of them Americans, hoping to have got back in time for the Thanksgiving holiday. Quentin also told us earlier the Thai government has fled to the north.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. So in the financial crisis, and as the markets opened this morning, it looks like about a 3% decline for the Dow Jones Industrial Average this morning. In the financial crisis, if banks don't lend, then the economy shuts down. But in Italy, the Italian Shopkeepers Association says that, well, banks may not be lending, but 180,000 firms have already been forced to get the cash they need, not from banks, but from organized crime groups. So following this story is BBC correspondent Duncan Kennedy, who joined us earlier from Rome. I asked him if I were to, like, zap into my organized crime loan sharking outfit there in Rome, I mean, what kind of interest rate could I get?
3%? 4.5%. 4.5.
Yeah, right.
In my I'm not kidding.
Really?
The businessman we spoke to who went to the mob to get these loans that his bank turned him down for was quoted 4.5%.
That is staggering. So organized crime is actually coming in to backstop the financial situation in Italy.
Exactly that. This man in particular, he was the one this organization of shopkeepers put up for us, went to his bank. They said, yeah, we can have the money in 6 months' time. He said, no, obviously need it before then, otherwise my business goes under. So he made a phone call, He's totally legitimate himself. He's not a crook or anything like that. Ended up talking to a mobster here in Naples. It's called the Camorra. And the mobster said, yeah, no problem. 24 hours later, met the man in an apartment building. He went away, came back with a black plastic bin liner full of 50,000 euros. What's that, about $60,000, $70,000. And said, here's your money, 4.5% interest a month.
Wow. Now, it's a slightly labor-intensive way of running a bank with, like, three phone calls and people have to deliver the money to you in suitcases. But that's actually
you could do 1-800-CRIME or something, wouldn't you? That'd make it a lot easier.
Yeah, Camorra Bank, you know, come on in. We'll help you out.
And of course, he one thing led to another. He couldn't make those repayments, met another mobster. In the end, he was in debt to seven mobsters, this one guy. And the next bit is something straight out of a movie, because they then sent round the heavies. And the way this man describes it is two young men in designer suits came round, no ties. And one of them opened his jacket to reveal a gun. Another one made his like stabbing movements with his finger, told him they knew where he lived, knew his movements. And if he didn't pay up, he could expect trouble. And this guy was really, really scared.
It's a little more painful than your $1.50 ATM fee there, I guess. So, so Duncan, is this being viewed as predation on the part of organized crime or some sort of natural operation of the gray economy?
I think a bit of both. I think there's a genuine traditional problem here in Italy with getting money from banks. They've been traditionally very conservative. It's all been made worse by this credit crunch. As you said, about 180,000 businesses turning to the mob in the past year alone. So there's obviously a liquidity issue here. Estimated that the mob made something like $15 billion from this kind of loan operation. Out of a total of $87 billion, you know, vastly out making money from all the corporations here. They reckon it's the equivalent of 6% wow. of the Italian GDP that they're responsible for. So and they're big really, numbers all around.
They're really called the men in ties, and we got to go?
They're men really without ties.
They're called the men without ties?
Yes.
Just go see the men without ties. It's a curious backstop for the Italian economy. The mob is lending money, and apparently as many as 200,000 Italian businesses are taking advantage of it. Duncan Kennedy is a BBC correspondent. He explained the whole thing and is following the story. Maybe we'll get an update. He joined us from Rome. The markets are down this morning. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is bouncing around negative 300 points. That's down 300 points in the early going.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We begin with Femi Okeh in the headlines.
Hello there. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is headed to India to offer support for the government there after the terror attacks. Speaking in London this morning, Rice stressed the importance of Pakistan helping India to investigate. She also talked about Hillary Clinton, the woman set to take her job.
I know that she will bring enormous energy and intellect and skill to the position. And most importantly, I know her to be somebody who has what you need most in this job, which is a deep love for the United States of America.
That was a very nice reference. Meanwhile, President-elect Barack Obama will name other key cabinet posts today. Robert Gates will stay on at the Defense Department. The president-elect will also announce his Attorney General and Homeland Security Chief nominees. Now, most Obama cabinet members will spend a great deal of time dealing with Iraq. There is some news out of there today, not encouraging. More than 30 are dead after a string of bombings targeted Americans and Iraqis in Baghdad and Mosul. And this in the week after Iraq's parliament approved a security deal regarding the American troop presence. Brazil's president publicly prayed for divine help to stop the deadly floods in his country. More than 100 people are dead and tens of thousands more homeless. Forecasters expect more mudslides as the soaking loosens the ground. And the government of Iran is setting up a network of marriage bureaus to help young Iranians find a husband or a wife. It says the centers will advise on the traditional way of finding a spouse. And that's a look at your news for now.
Well, some hopeful news there. So do you have what it takes to realize your American dream, Femi?
I'm trying.
Yeah, well, maybe you don't, because success makes you soft. What do they say on Oprah? You may have heard this. Yeah. If it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger.
Okay.
We are evolved to cope with adversity and scarcity, but abundance in the United States and with the longstanding prosperity since World War II, it's made us all fat. Have you noticed?
Yes, a few times, yes. Well, particularly in Florida.
It's made us here in America broke. Mm-hmm. It's made us very anxious about dealing with the current crisis. And UCLA neuroscientist Peter Wybrow says the economic downturn could tap into our primal brain chemistry and actually make us function better. He joins us now by phone from Santa Monica, California. Peter, thanks for being part of the program.
Absolutely.
You know, this is a pretty interesting premise because, you know, the American dream is predicated on patient, hardworking, indefatigable workers who come up with interesting ideas and stick with them to make them work. It seems as though the prosperity of the last couple of generations has made us unable to be patient and do anything except instant gratification.
Well, that's correct. Yes, I believe so.
So what are we going to do about that?
Well, I think actually it's being done for us, as you just said. The fact is that the prosperity has disappeared, or at least momentarily it's disappearing, and we have to come back to thinking about how we deal with less. And that actually puts into gear, I think, the best of human intuition and the best of human thinking.
So what is it about our brains that primally hardwired to have trouble with abundance?
Well, we grew up, evolutionary speaking, in scarcity. Now, the brain is really quite ancient, and it's put together in three pieces. We have an old lizard brain in there that keeps everything running, and then the mammals that gave us attachment to others. But the most recent part of the brain, the part that makes us human, the executive brain, as it's called, in the frontal lobes, just above the eyes, is the thinking part. If everything's working well, they work together. But unfortunately, when you give prosperity to any animal of our capacity, they tend to lull themselves into complacency. And then the old lizard brain takes over, and we just want more and more. We want it now, and we want as much as we can get. And in that case, the old executive brain tends to be held in thrall by the lizard, and we're off to the races. And I think that's what you've seen. We get fat and content and don't think too much. And after a while, for all we know, we're just sitting there on the couch flipping the television set. So
I love that image, Peter. Fat lizards sitting on the couch, not questioning anything. And one of the other things you write about is that inequality and insecurity are bred from this concern about losing what it is we have. And so in many ways, growth does not produce contentment, but more anxiety.
Exactly. What happens is that in the complexity of it, you know, markets are actually run by self-interest and by curiosity and by social ambition. Particularly, everybody is competing for the, if you think about it from the evolutionary standpoint again, we're all competing for the same trough, because years ago when we grew up in scarcity, if you didn't eat quickly, somebody else might eat what you had in front of you. So in this circumstance, we're highly competitive, but those particular activities are only part of the market. The rest of it is being fair, sharing, et cetera, which in small communities used to work very well. But now we've escalated our markets to situations where actually there is very little social control. The executive brain doesn't control itself. We just give over to the rampant joy of getting everything for ourselves as soon as we want it.
Well, in a first blush kind of look, I mean, what you argue actually does seem positive in that adversity is going to force us to get a little more discipline into our strategic outlook and the kinds of choices that we make for ourselves and our families. But in a $6 billion world, there's also maybe a sobering Malthusian argument in here, in that if you're not going to be patient and if you can't get control of your lizard brain, you're not going to make it. And that could be pretty destabilizing for the world.
That could be. Obviously, it will be good if we can slow down slowly, as it were. But I still think that in countries like our own, where we're extraordinarily well off, we're very affluent in many, many ways, not only in terms of money, but in terms of ideas and technology and talent, I think that we will start to think again about ways in which we can create a society which is sustainable. And I think that's actually going to be a big plus in the long run. America could become an exemplar in terms of managing affluence, because the world is rushing towards that, or it was until a few months ago, and we have to learn how to manage with considerable material possessions. We can't just presume that more of what we have is what the future will be, because that will destroy everything that we have around us in terms of natural resources and so on. Even our cultural infrastructure, I think, as you've seen, has begun to be tattered. We were just talking before the break there about people calling in, talking about their own circumstance and whether or not they were making it in these down times. That means our social infrastructure is eroding just as our physical infrastructure is eroding.
Well, in your book, American Mania, When More Is Not Enough, you argue, at least implicitly, that perhaps growth and success in hardwire terms produces a sense of taking ridiculous risks, and that some of the risks that produce this economic downturn are direct neural consequences of a kind of complacency, and that adversity will keep us from falling for those stupid things going forward.
Yes, that's basically the argument. I mean, if you take the recent meltdown of which started with the housing boom, basically there what happened was that everybody was caught in the material dream of everybody wanting a house, and that was pushed, and then some very smart people began to think, how can I manage this to my advantage? And so with all the derivatives and the various financial wizardry that went on, suddenly we had out there a tsunami of financial instruments that nobody quite understood, and the technology that we had created for ourselves suddenly came back to haunt us, and we found we didn't really understand it.
Well, Peter Wybrow, being smart is a function of good timing. That is at least very, very clear from your research. Peter Wybrow is director of the Semmel Institute for Neuroscience and Human Behavior at UCLA. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
So we're exploring this adversity that many of you are dealing with in this economic turndown at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You say underemployed. I say real estate agent, because in Hudson County, New Jersey, in 1993, there were 1,500 agents, and by 2006, there were 4,400 real estate agents, most of them people who had been downsized.
Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're looking at how you're coping with adversity, but mostly we're looking at the underemployed. Do you have a part-time job? Do you have a temporary job? Subscribe to our podcast at thetakeaway.org or iTunes, and here's your takeaway.
I think the Mumbai attack showed that no matter how much you think your administration may be about one thing, the economy at the moment, the national security can raise its head at any given moment.
And in about 40 minutes, the Obama transition team will raise its head and roll out its security team, announcing that the Secretary of State will be Hillary Clinton. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway